Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
You. Do you know that bad girls go to hell? Bad girls. See the boldest and most intimate scenes ever shown on any screen. In Bad Girls Go to Hell. See sex without shame. See violence in a story that is brutally honest. In Bad Girls Go to Hell. These are the men possessed with sex, corrupt and immoral, who prey upon women. They are the thrill seekers. This is a picture with a new kind of raw, naked realism.
You know that I love you. Why are you leaving? I love you too. That's why I must go.
If you want to see a film that dares to tell all, that is truly a body and soul shocker, then you must see Bad Girls Go to Hell.
Here's the thing. I'm not saying that somebody at some point in your life didn't tell you that a hot dog was a sausage and that they were the same thing. I'm just saying that just because somebody told you that doesn't necessarily make it so. Just because you were taught that they have the same attributes, so therefore they have the same name, that's not always the case. See what I'm saying? All right. As long as we're clear. It is 17 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of July, the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for coming along and joining us on this, Monday. It is 503-505-6964 if you'd like to be part of today's show. 503-505-6964. Our phone lines are... Wait. And yes, now open. There you go. 503-505-6964. For your comments, questions, clarifications, kvetches, ponderings, ruminations, musings of an ironic nature, limerick, haiku, whatever it is. No haiku, actually. I take that back. It's more of a limerick day. The limerick is the poem of the people. I think haiku is sort of haiku is a bit of a showy sort of a poetic form. So today we're going to, in fact, for the remainder of the week, no haiku at all. Limerick only. I will accept haikus of a bawdy nature. But other than that, limerick only. If you want to email, you can do that. It's rick@rickemerson.com. Rick@RickEmerson.com or Dawn@RickEmerson.com, and the chat box is open as well at RickEmerson.com, the website. So once again, the chat box at RickEmerson.com. You can email. It's Rick@RickEmerson.com, and the phone lines are open at 503-505-6964. About what sorts of things might you call today? I'm glad you asked. Here's what's coming up today. Top five. Now, it's sort of a continuation of Friday's top five. On Friday, we had a special two-part version of this radio program which were then sort of stitched together and just broadcast as one all weekend long on the Rick Emerson live stream. Dawn had this top five on Friday that I thought was great. I'm not saying it was entirely misguided or that I disagree with it as such. I'm just saying that there are many different ways to approach a subject, and I will be taking my own crack at it today. Today we'll do the top five soundtracks that are better than the movie from which they came. Top five soundtracks better than the movie that created them. Also, Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian, will be here. We'll have the return of the week in Geek with Aaron Duran. Dawn's writing a note.
I was trying to write
Hold
you a
on.
Note.
Hold on. Turn it. What does it say here?
Well, I didn't finish writing it yet. Bruce would like to
drop
remind
the
you
mono
to
bed.
Drop the Nicecast stream to 32K.
Oh, damn it. All right. Well, I got to turn everybody off then. All right. Hold on a second. Hold on. Let me just stop everything and adjust the Nicecast stream. Hold on a second. There we go. All right. And there we go. I hope everybody's happy.
So that logged people out, and now they have to log back in, or
yes.
What did that do?
No, that's totally what that did. I had to. This doesn't affect people who were listening. Yeah, it's a long story. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
It's a whole thing. A little technical. It's. I had to make it all 220. I'm sorry. It's been like a month since I made a Mr. Mom reference or a Michael Keaton reference many times. So it was time to do it. Anyway. So on Friday. Dawn had the top five songs that were, you know, that were better than, you know, soundtracks that were better than the movie that created them. So I got to do my own crack at that today. Ryan White from The Oregonian is going to be here. Aaron Duran's Week in Geek makes its triumphant return to the program. We'll recap last night's episode of True Blood, which I don't mean to get ahead of myself here, but the thing about True Blood is I can't figure out what is. First of all, I can't figure out what is keeping me watching that show sometimes. It. I get about halfway through an episode and I just think, what in the name of sweet Christ, what am I doing with my life? I could be picking out socks. I could be cleaning. I could be filing down my toenails. But instead, I'm just watching a guy who was a Viking and then I guess he was a Nazi at some point, but then he was like a Visigoth or something. I just that Eric guy, who apparently has just. You know, lived in every time and on every continent and in every walk of life. And Sookie, who now has become like she's like the Emperor Palpatine and whatnot because she's able to like shoot lightning bolts out of her hands and knock guys across the room. The whole thing was just so unspeakably bizarre. And I just wrote this down last night. I made a few notes about True Blood. I'm not going to get into a whole bunch of these, but we'll wait and do these later. I just made this note at about 9:55. I just wrote True Blood, and then I put a question mark after because, like, I wasn't entirely convinced. I just put True Blood, gayest show on television? Question mark. But I mean, really, I am prepared now to make that less an interrogative statement and more of a declarative one. True Blood, gayest show on television? Even an exclamatory gayest show on television. There's nothing gayer. The gay mayor of Gaydonia is not as gay as True Blood is. I mean, it's unreal. Not that I mind, you understand. I'm just saying it's pretty goddamned gay. I mean, it's amazingly gay. It is jaw-droppingly, mind-blowingly gay.
There's a whole lot of gay there.
It's a whole lot of gay. All right. Anyway, what else? Well, that's it. We got Taser Watch coming up today, Cheney Watch, Penis Watch, Ryan White from The Oregonian, The Return of the Weekend Geek, part two of the top five from Friday. Dawn did her take on the soundtracks better than films that created them. I'll do my take and talk about my Leverage audition here in just a few. Before we do anything else, by the way, I want to welcome to the Rick Emerson Show. We have a couple of sponsors who have joined the program as of today, helping to provide this program to you, helping to maintain the low, low cost of only 32 cents a day and showing their solidarity and alliance with all of us, the Rick Emerson faithful. The Cleaning Solution, about whom we will speak more later on, in the person of Michael Beatty, is the owner and the proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. The phone number is 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211.
I just got that's kind of a play on words. Cleaning Solution.
Yes. No, see, it's an answer and it's also a substance.
I just got that.
All right. Glad you could join us today, Dawn. Dawn Taylor playing the home version of the Rick Emerson Show in the corner. It's 971-533-3211. Find out more about The Cleaning Solution. Michael Beatty is the owner there, and we will talk more about that later on this hour. All right, I don't even know where to begin. All of this stuff to get to, but I know that I said that I would talk about the Leverage audition, which happened on Friday. So if you were listening on Friday, there was this whole thing that happened. Friday was just, what did you call it? Did you say it was off-kilter? Was that
it
the
was
way you described
kilter.
Friday's show? It wasn't a bad show. It wasn't like there was anything wrong with it. It was just, it was just one of those things where we always seem to be within about an inch and a half of losing complete control.
Everything just felt screwy all day.
It wasn't like it was a spiraling disaster of a broadcast. Not quite, not as such. But like at any moment, it could have become that. It just sort of threatened to become dangerously unstable at several points during the show. Not least of which, because like at 2:30, just as we were sort of rolling into your top five and your triple feature segment, I mean, I had the blow because I had to get to North Portland to audition for Leverage. And this is in an entirely different role. This is not for the highly sought after part of the morgue attendant. That was actually the last thing I didn't get. This was, I should have actually, I think I brought the actual script with me. I auditioned for not one, not two, but three different roles back to back on Friday.
Wow.
All of them reporters, all of them newscasters, all of them with an accent. And it was the, let me see if I can read the description here. Let me see if I can. Here's my voiceover stuff for Friday's Leverage audition. So this is now, if I am counting correctly, and I believe I am, I think this is actually the fourth time I've auditioned for Leverage. It is the 1, 2, 3. This, if you count all of these separately, is the fourth time I have auditioned for Leverage, and it's the ninth role for which I have auditioned. By the way, I checked my voicemail before the program, and strangely enough, I don't know if they've lost my contact number or if...
They probably can't decide yet which of these roles to give you because you were just so awesome at all of them.
You know what? You can die. You can die is what you can do. That's what... You can die slowly, cut into 1,000 pieces. All right. There's no need for that kind of caustic wit. I'm sure they're just trying to figure out if they can somehow cast you in all of the roles simultaneously, Rick Emerson, because you're so fantastically talented. So I auditioned for several different variations of reporter, and I think I read this on Friday. It was a little bit of a description about what they were looking for here. It says, and thank you, by the way, for here's how helpful Dawn is. So I'm getting ready to go to the Leverage audition on Friday. And by the way, the show, I don't know if I mentioned this, you know, maybe 9 or 10,000 times, that I've auditioned for repeatedly in the past and failed. So on Friday, what could I be? A little support, maybe? A little help? Let me put you in the right frame of mind. Let me give you a little positive reinforcement, constructive criticism, give you an affirmation, some sort of a Tony Robbins thing to take out. No, here's what I get from Dawn on Fridays. I'm getting ready to leave. I say, oh, I got to stay, because there's this whole thing where you go to an audition where you got to have a headshot, which is the gay-looking, you know, like glossy photo of yourself, and then on the back, you were supposed to put your resume. You staple your resume to the back, so they can say, "What? Who's this fine-looking fellow?" And then they sort of they say, "Oh, Tim Riley. Let's call him." So I'm putting together my resume, my headshot, and Dawn says, "Well, that's weird. You know, your headshot looks kind of strange." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she's, "Well, normally when people get a headshot, you know, what did you call it? You said it was washed out, or
no, it's a full bleed."
I don't know what that means. What is your fancy actor talk?
That's not fancy actor talk. That's printing lingo.
All right, but what
that means the picture goes all the way up to the edge. There's no border.
I don't have the page. There's no white framing around my
my
picture.
And most, pretty much every headshot, professional headshot I've ever seen, there's a border around the edge. It's wider in the white on the bottom, and in that white area in the bottom, that's where your agent's contact information is put.
So what you're basically saying. Or in point of fact, saying is that I have an unprofessional-looking headshot.
I have been out of the acting game for a long time.
Things might have changed.
So this could be the way the kids are doing it these days. I don't know. I just thought it was odd. It was.
See, why do you have to use that again? That odd. That's what's in my head right as I'm going out the door, and I'm gonna head because you know the first
I'm
thing.
Sorry, I didn't. It didn't occur to me that this would like put you off your game.
You can't try to psych me out like that. It's like, you know, you're like Larry Bird trying to get inside the mind of Dr. J and succeeding, Because you know how it is. I mean, you go to an audition, and the first thing that happens when you walk in the door, the very first thing is that they will ask for your headshot and your resume.
So
and
now what? You're looking at everyone else's headshots and going, damn it, they have borders around them.
It's not even thinking. It's like walking in and every single other headshot and resume that I look at has, you know, has your fancy schmancy white border around it with the contact information for your agent at the bottom. And I'm here with my sad, like, went to Walgreens with a coupon. I'm trying to do me some acting. Can you... Do you mind printing me up some of them headshotifications with my resume file on the back so I can... You know, it's like I'm one of the clampets going in to try to get an acting gig. Because the first thing that happens when you walk into any acting audition, especially a callback, which there's a woman at the front, and the very first thing is she says, headshot and resume. And, like, it is, like... serious business with these people. Like, if you don't have your headshot and your resume, like, they will send you home. Yeah. You will be... It's like a kid coming to school without his polio vaccine. They will send you back.
Well, that's what they use later to remember who you were and to put you in the we like you or we don't like you stacks.
Yeah, because they see like a million people. No, I'm not. I understand why they do it, but it's the very first. So, but it is the first thing you do when you walk in. It's the very first impression. And so I walk in the door the whole time thinking, stupid headshots, the white border. Tom thinks I'm a failure.
Very nice picture.
Thanks so much. It's too late now. That bell can't be unrung. It's nice of you to say, but it's not gonna have, the desired effect. So I walk in, and the woman who holds my life in her hand says, "Headshot and resume, please." And I'm like, "Hey, look out the window. There's a fire across the street. Here you go." You know, just trying to stick it into the pile so nobody can see it. So then. I don't know what is the last thing for which you auditioned? I mean, you said it's been a long time. Was it like a movie or a TV show? Do you remember?
I think it was a play.
A play. You walk in. Who was doing the? Was it just the director doing his own casting, or did he have somebody casting it for him, like a casting director?
The director was doing the casting, but there were like other people sitting there. Obviously, it was going to be discussed by several people. It might have been the playwright, and then other people working on the play.
So let me give you a little overview of how my auditions have worked in the past. So typically I walk in and there is an assistant casting director. Now the place I go and I won't mention her name, even though I have in the past, because I don't want to seem like I'm picking. I'm really not, because this is really about me. But if you've heard me talk about in the past, there really is in Portland, if you're an actor, there is, and let's be clear about this. I am not yet an actor because I keep failing at my audition, so I'm an actor sort of in theory. I'm a hypothetical actor. I'm like a beta actor. But there's one casting agency, basically. There is one casting agency that handles everything. So everybody, if you've done any sort of commercial audition or movie editor, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You walk in, but it's like an assistant, you know, or like an assistant to the assistant. Because, you know, it's like a cattle call most of the time. It's like 500 guys there, and they're all trying to be man from left or something. Then if you go back for a callback, which is where you're good enough that they want to see you a second time. They want to take a second look at you because they think, you know, you've made the first cut. You walk in and the person who runs the casting agency is there for the callback. If you're there for the second try, like if you make it through the first pass, you go back, person who runs the whole joint, she's there. Sometimes you'll get like one of the producers from the show who will sit in, screens all the auditioners, and then maybe looks at the videotapes or, you know, whatever. Watches the playback later, and then hands a few of them off. Let me ask you this, Don. Just knowing what you know about me and my many neuroses, who is the worst person who could have been sitting in the room actually running the entire casting process for Leverage when I walked in?
Dean Devlin.
No. Oh. No, but you're missing the obvious. No, no, of course not.
Timothy Hutton.
No, because I've never. I'm screaming at people.
I would say probably the woman who does all of the casting for you have met.
No, see, no? See, because you're yeah, you're totally missing the makeup of Rick Emerson.
Oh, okay.
Dean Devlin, who is a big shot Hollywood producer, as they say, and who is one of the guys who produces Leverage. Dean Devlin, I mean, I don't mean to sound, it's not like I don't get starstruck, I do, but Dean Devlin didn't freak me out because I've never met him, you know? I have no...
So John Rogers?
It was John Rogers. There you go. John Rogers, who was on this show, who's been on Outlook Portland.
But that would put you at ease.
And who, no, because here's the thing. Dean Devlin, I mean, give me a little bit of Dean Devlin, who was one of the producers on Leverage. Give me a little bit of his resume. Tell folks, you know. Because didn't he, wasn't he one
did
of the...
Did he do the Roland Emmerich movies, too?
And he did the Independence Day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And Godzilla and whatever. I mean, he's produced huge movies. But it, you know, but I know zero about that guy other than the fact that, like, hey, you produced Independence Day. I mean, he's a blank to me. I'm not saying that's not impressive. It is. But it's, you know, but I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. I don't know anything about him. I have no personality read on Dean Devlin. Again.
But I would think, though, that you go into an audition and the guy's sitting there and you go, oh, that's a guy who picked Bill Pullman for a movie. And now he's going to decide whether or not I should be on his TV show.
Well, really.
That would be more nerve-wracking than somebody that you've met before and that you think already kind of likes you.
Well, let's be honest. If he picked Bill Pullman for a movie, then I might be in, baby, because I can do bland. I can do bland and lifeless. I can do tepid. What I need you to do is to be just sort of a warm glass of water, but like, you know, a person. Can you do that? Yes, I can. Dean Devlin, and again, I'm not trying to sound like that somehow I'm not impressed by Dean Devlin and the fact that he's not a big deal. He is a huge deal, and he is, as they say, a big shot in Hollywood. But I have no sense of him as a person. Don't have any idea what he's like. I don't ever think I've seen a picture of him. I don't think I'd know him if I passed him, if he's in the hallway, I don't think I recognize him. John Rogers is, as we found out last week, and as I knew from when he was on Outlook Portland, he's like the coolest guy on earth. I mean, he's like he may in fact be the king of the geeks. I mean, not just here, but like everywhere. He may sit on a throne made of the skulls of other geeks at his house. He's a guy that you want to be cool around. And if you know anything about me, as Lester Bangs would say, I'm not cool. There's nothing that I could not possibly be less cool. And the thing is, they didn't tell me. They told me it was going to be Dean Devlin. They told me I think I read you the email.
Yeah.
It said, you know, Dean Devlin has flagged several people who should be coming back for the and that didn't actually even freak me out when they said that Dean Devlin, and I'm not trying to brag, lots of guys got this email, lots of people got this, but they said Dean Devlin picked a handful of people that he wants to see again for the whatever. Didn't bother me at all. You know why? Don't care if I impress Dean Devlin. He could be a cool guy. Maybe he's not a cool guy. I don't know. Don't know anything about it. Walk in. Hello, Dean Devlin. You know, and then I get the, you know, dun, 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 and there's John Rogers. He goes, and he's like, hey, man, how's it going? And I was like, oh, it's going great. We had the off-kilter show, and I was speeding there. And oh, and here's the other thing, by the way, just if I can just vent a little bit more about my Leverage audition. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's possible that maybe there's been a Verizon outage of some kind, and maybe they've attempted to call me many dozens of times, maybe the circuits are busy. Maybe, in fact, so many people are trying to call me for the part that my phone simply can't accept any more incoming calls. That could be it. So here's the other thing, is that I had read you this description on Friday, where it says, this accent is a cross between French and Italian. Think of it as a Franco-Italian Riviera-like principality, somewhere between Malta and Corsica. I don't even know where Malta or Corsica are, by the way. I guess they're in Europe somewhere. I only know they're in Europe because it then says, you may or may not then be asked to do any particular role with a European accent of your choice, of my many, many European accents, of the panoply of accents that are in my repertoire. So I get in, and the assistant, the one who asked me for the headshot and the resume, she says, by the way, that accent thing, don't worry about that. She's like, there's just one of these roles is going to have an accent, and even then, we're only going to have you do that for one of the pages, because like a couple of the auditions, a couple pages long. There's three reporters. She says, you know, it's just reporter three, and really, it's just that one paragraph toward the end. We'll have you do that with an accent. The rest of them, neutral voice. And I'm thinking, bam, baby. Rick Emerson is suddenly, he's back in the game. Rick Emerson is a player now in this thing. He's a contender. Because you know what? I do Outlook Portland every week. I'm on television. I can be a newscaster, you know? An area man found something shocking in his backyard. It was a blah, 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 legless man on a horse. I can do those inflections. I know what I'm doing. And so when she says, don't worry about the accent, that's just one paragraph for one of the reporters, I am in like Flynn, right? I walk in. First of all, there's John Rogers sitting behind it. And it's John Rogers next to the woman who runs the whole joint, who could just grind me into so much actor powder underneath one of her boots. And then what does John Rogers say? Hey, man, so you know these are all with accents today, right? And then it's just, and then at that point, I just feel like I don't even know what to believe. It's just like a world gone mad. I feel like I've fallen into some sort of a Fincher movie where just the up is down and left is right and Malta is America and I started to feel like Daffy Duck in that duck season, rabbit season thing where I've, you know, Malta, Riviera, fire, bam. So, anyway. So that audition went really well, as you might imagine. My final note on this is, I should tell you that I did practice these really to a great degree. I spent a lot of time sounding like Ricardo Montalban, which is sort of how I ended up doing all of these, you know, the taste of rich Corinthian leather, or, you know, whatever it is that he did in the Buick commercials, whatever those were, the Liz Saber. What was that for? Was it Liz Chrysler?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there at home modeling myself.
Valare.
Modeling myself on Ricardo Montalban, who is from where I do not know.
I believe he's Mexican.
Well, whatever. That's like Europe. It's like a southern sort of Europe. It's a hotter southern Europe with corn and pyramids. Anyway, the point is that I was busy practicing this accent, but, you know, the thing about the audition process is that they just go, they take you through it, just like bam, bam, bam. I mean, there is no let me stop and find my moment. There is like, go, reporter one, okay, reporter two, go. And you're just, it's like you were playing some sort of thespian dodgeball. So, and then I got in the car and just, wept silently to myself all the way back here to the studio to do the second half of that show.
So do we get to hear an actual example of the accent?
Yes, but you don't get to do it this time because you were mean to me. So when Ryan White gets here, we'll have Ryan White be I'll have to go through because
not mean to
I
you.
Do believe these are actually these are spoilerific. I have to edit them down a little bit because these are from the season finale, for which Dean Devlin wanted to see me, and then he didn't show up. He sent John Rogers to unnerve me.
And I was not mean to you.
All done in an accent. Gonna go burn these headshots now. Somebody's saying post your headshot. Here's the thing that you all have actually seen. Cheryl says on the text, I thought John Rogers might be at your audition. Thanks for mentioning that. I you've all actually seen my headshot. It is actually the photo that I use on my Facebook. If you go to my Facebook page, my Facebook profile picture, that is actually my headshot. How was your weekend, Don Taylor?
Not nearly that exciting.
Yeah.
I
you didn't have all the drinking and self-loathing.
No, I went to the library, and I made macaroni and cheese.
That's the life of kings you lead over there, isn't it?
There's the thing. I was thinking about this weekend. Previously, you had the lovely Sarah Dillon to work with, and I'm sure not a Monday went by without there being tales of debauchery and adventures and mayhem. I am much more boring than that. I realized maybe I should get out more and do things just so I have stuff to talk about. But no, I made macaroni and cheese, which I understand you're not a fan of.
I do not care for homemade macaroni and cheese, only because that's not. I do not care for homemade macaroni and cheese for the same reason that I don't like real Christmas trees, because. And I realize that I'm an aberration here. I recognize that I'm the exception, that I, in effect, view things incorrectly. But growing up, I never had a real tree, I think until 2 years ago when Laura and I got one. And
I never had one until I moved here.
And so they look fake to me because we always had an artificial tree when I was a kid. And so that, to me, in my head, because in my formative years, that's what I saw. So that's what a real tree is like. Same thing with macaroni. I wouldn't even get the credit at the, it was called Townhouse then, but that was the Safeway brand of macaroni and cheese, which to this day, I love boxed macaroni and cheese. I mean, unironically, unkitschily, it is one of my favorite foods. And I'm sure that homemade macaroni and cheese is good in an objective sense. I just, if it was called something else, I think I'd like it. But it's just, you say macaroni and cheese, and I start thinking aluminum foil packet, you know, and so I find it difficult to enjoy.
Well, I think I will bring some and see if you might actually get, because I do make it from scratch, use sharp, nothing but sharp cheddar, use a little bit of onion, and I also boost it up with some hot sauce, extra mustard, and I cut up a bunch of kielbasa and put smoked sausage in it.
Kielbasa hot dogs?
Kielbasa are not hot dogs. They're a separate type of sausage from the hot dog.
Woman. All right. You know, here's the thing. Ryan White's a journalist. And when he gets in here, we're going to ask him about this whole hot dog versus sausage thing.
We will.
All right. Well, we're behind. So let's do this. Let's do a little bit of news. And we'll take a break here in a bit. And Ryan White will join us. Also coming up today, Week in Geek with Aaron Duran. Top 5 True Blood recap. Would you spill that soda? It's going to be hell to pay for all of us.
I know.
I'm telling you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, at the news desk, it is the incredibly tolerant Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
The federal government Monday allowed BP to keep the cap shut tight on its ruptured Gulf of Mexico oil well for another day, despite something seeping near the ocean floor.
Something seeping. That's like, well, I made this reference during Legion of News, but that's like when they, you know, they say that, you know, something has survived, you know, the, you know, whatever the, like in Cloverfield 2 or something. Or
I just started hearing that Nancy Sinatra song in my head about saying something stupid that I love you.
I'm sorry. I was
hearing something seeping.
I was just distracted by the series of supportive messages from our chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa, who says, you know about leverage, I think they're deliberately picking accent roles for you now. They're probably creating a reel of your failed auditions for their Christmas party. Thank you.
Is there any way that we could actually get a reel of your failed auditions for our Christmas party? Do you think they'd give it to us if we asked?
Moving right along, this is Don Taylor, news guys. This is Don Taylor.
Do you want to keep talking about the BP oil thing, or should I?
Sure, why not? Go ahead, have at it.
The Obama administration's point man, retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen. So that is that short for Thaddeus?
But see, when you say Thad, I always assume that it's Tad. I always assume the T is silent. But then
you mean the H?
The H is silent. But then I think like, well, what would it be short for? And then you think, well, it is Thaddeus. But then you
realize.
And
I've heard the CNN people say Thad.
Well, because there are guys named Thad. I interviewed a filmmaker. A guy did a movie called it's called My Father's War or something. The filmmaker, his name was Thad something or other. Thad Rogers, I think, is his name. But then you think, well, you know, Thaddeus, so it must be. But then Thad sounds weird. Thad sounds like it sounds like you're mispronouncing something. You're like you're missing your front teeth or whatever. And also, I'm painfully aware that in America, the shortened versions of names, you know, and nicknames don't have to have anything to do. I mean, Jack and John have nothing to do with one another. So that's not really a roadmap for you. I just don't know.
Well, I honestly don't understand people who are in positions of great authority, like, you know, a Coast Guard admiral, and they continue to use a shortened version of their name. I mean, even if someone
called himself Jimmy.
Yeah. Even if everybody did call him Thad in day-to-day life, for professional reasons, when you're talking to the press and when you're doing stuff, wouldn't you use Thaddeus?
I suppose. I would call myself Thaddeus just because it makes it seem like I ought to own a lot of land somewhere and be able to sip on mint juleps whenever I want to. All I know is that in the Stephen King movie The Dark Half, the character of Mr. Beaumont, his first name was T-H-A-D and it was pronounced Tad. So that's kind of where I base everything. So. But that's, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that that applies. Your mileage
saying. It's like now the wheels are spinning in my head and I realize that that's precisely why I probably assumed that it was pronounced Tad the first time I read it.
Yeah.
Is because of that book.
Yes. Let's spend all
damn
day
you, Stephen King.
Talking about this.
Let's go on to something
It's just
else.
A non-answerable question, unfortunately. It's just one of those things that can't ever be. It can't be known. It's an unknown unknown.
Just move on to all something. Right. Police arrested a man who said that police arrested a man who they said punched another man who refused to hug him. Iowa City police responded to a report of
Show me affection now!
Responded to a report of someone being aggressive and punching cars Sunday night. The suspect, a 23-year-old man, told police he became upset after he tried to hug a man and was pushed away. Police said the man punched and dented the hood of a car before punching the man he tried to hug. Police said the man had a blood alcohol content of 0.086. He was charged with simple assault and fourth-degree criminal mischief.
Sure, this is another one of your guys who was on ecstasy, the so-called hug drug. Is that a thing that is really true? Do you really, if you take ecstasy, Don Taylor, which, which you've done, was it once or many times?
Twice.
Twice. So now
maybe three times. It's been a long time.
Did you have the overwhelming urge to embrace your fellow humans?
I didn't because I'm just not a hugger by nature.
Well, I thought that was the point, though, that because they were talking, last hour in Legion of News, you said they were using it for, like, PTSD guys, among other folks. And they, you know, the PTSD people have, like, a big aversion to physical contact sometimes. And I thought that it maybe helped you break through the wall.
Well, what it does is it just makes everything seem better and happier. I mean, when they say euphoria, I mean, you really do genuinely understand what euphoria is if you take ecstasy. It's like everything that you look at that is cool looks cooler. I mean, you're not hallucinating in any way. Everything is just better. So things taste better. Physical sensations feel better. And then when it comes to people, if I liked someone,
you
loved them. And even people I didn't like very much, I'd actually just like, you know, you're not so bad. But I'd see somebody that I really liked a lot, and I'd be like, I love him so much.
It's fantastic.
So, yeah.
I just remember that scene. There was, I think it was the second season of Californication, which I think you haven't watched actually, but where Charlie and Marcy, what is his name? Evan Handler and. What the hell is her name? I can never remember her name. Pamela Adlon. Are out of the hallway outside of Hank's apartment, and they've dropped ecstasy. Now I sound like an old guy. You kid, dropping your weed and whatnot. But they've taken ecstasy, and they were out there just sort of like running their hands along along each other's sleeves because the fabric was the best feeling thing that they had ever experienced in their life. And the only person I ever knew in real life who had done ecstasy several times, I don't even know how to put this. I don't even know how to phrase this. The only person I have ever known who took ecstasy, I won't even say compulsively, I didn't say that she took it a lot, but you know, she went through a phase, let's say. She went through a period where she took ecstasy several times. And she said that... she said the most stoned sounding thing to me, and she wasn't stoned when she said this, by the way. But I said, well, you know, because I'm, you know, the thing to me about drugs is that, not unlike with certain other illicit activities, I don't participate in them myself, but I am endlessly fascinated with them, and I will just drill other people for you know, all kinds of trivia and information and the musings upon it. But she had taken ecstasy several times, and I said, well, what was it like? And she was telling me this, some whole evening she'd spent at some party where everybody was all dosed on ecstasy. And she described the final stage, one might call it, of a particular intimate act.
Ah.
No, but see, you don't even know what I'm talking about.
Oh,
see,
okay.
Right? You see, you think you know what I'm talking about, but you don't.
Okay, apparently.
She described the final stage, not the climactic stage, but the final stage of a particular intimate act as being like ingesting pure love. That's what she said. She said it was like I was ingesting pure concentrated love. And I said, you are a good person to know. We ought to hang out more often.
There was a movie in the 80s called Aria that was a four-part film.
Yeah.
And Buck Henry played a character in one of the segments where he took ecstasy.
Aria.
And he was at whatever the name of that hotel in California where they have all of the weird rooms. There's the Elvis room, yeah, the Flintstones room. Yeah, and he's running around the hotel on ecstasy, just sort of touching everything and marveling at things. And that was actually a fairly good representative of what being completely stoned on ecstasy can be like.
See, and it just sounds like the best drug on earth. That's the other thing about ecstasy. It of all of the many drugs that I have coveted and not taken, that seems like really the one for me. If I had to pick it, if I had to start tomorrow on some kind of drug, I would probably pick cocaine, actually. But if it could, like, if that was off the table somehow, or so to speak, or if that were gone almost immediately, which I think it assuredly would be, I think I would move on to ecstasy. Because as I understand it, ecstasy is like some combination of speed and heroin, which just sounds righteous.
Well, the problem with it is that with ecstasy is that the same problem with doing too much cocaine is that it artificially boosts your serotonin. So it can actually burn out your serotonin receptors if you do too much of it. And it can cause people to get like deeply, deeply depressed and painfully screwed up later. Because they just can't manufacture serotonin the way they did previously.
Then you're the boy who doesn't know how to love.
Exactly.
Actually, one other observation about. But you know, I wonder how many hours out of the year we spend talking about drugs. You and I, for people who
we spend way too much time talking about drugs.
And the thing is, we're so lame. We're so hopelessly straight.
I know. It's like Sarah and Greg even have beer here, and you and I are sitting here drinking Vizo and Coke Zero, and we could be drinking beer. We're not at a regular radio station, but we don't.
You know what we sound like? We sound like people in recovery who are just having long detailed conversations about being intoxicated as a substitute for actually being intoxicated, which is especially retarded for me because I have no idea what it's like. So I have nothing but, you know, but the one other person I know actually who had done ecstasy, and not even a lot, she said that she did not do it because she described it as being, she said it was actually the only drug that she needed other drugs to come down from, because otherwise the crash, it was exactly what she said. She said that ecstasy was so great that if she did not then like step down using small amounts of other drugs, she would just crater and just be in the worst depression. Like she couldn't even leave the house for like a week. So, which sounds like less fun. Let's do one more and then we'll break and come back with Mr. Ryan White.
A controversial surgery that stops dogs from barking and cats from meowing will soon be illegal in Massachusetts. On Wednesday, the first-in-the-nation ban on devocalization surgery will go into effect in Massachusetts. The surgery involves cutting an animal's vocal cords to stop them from making sounds, according to the Humane Society. The measure, named Logan's Law, was signed into law by Governor Deval Patrick in April.
Is this going to involve some horrible mishap occurring to an animal?
No.
All right. Because as soon as you said Logan's, whenever there's a blanks law, it's always was raped and murdered and found in a ditch.
No.
All right.
Okay. Well, not a terrible.
Thanks.
It's named after a show dog that did receive the surgery.
Okay, but it wasn't
the anti-bark surgery.
Wasn't like the surgery that went horribly wrong or something, and then had to be burned.
No animals were killed in the making
of this law.
In this story,
all right.
The measure was signed into law after it received overwhelming bipartisan support. The surgery exposes animals to the possibilities of infection, blood loss, and scarred vocal cords.
Well, and also it doesn't work. Here's the thing. Whatever you think about dogs, the barking, it's this story, I mean, it's just an inaccurate description because it doesn't stop them from making noise.
No.
Because they make this horrible, they make a Jack Klugman sound, basically, is, you know, what they, can you go to the store and get me some smokes? That's what they did. They just sound like your Uncle Chester.
My next-door neighbors have a dog who is this adorable little fuzzy Shih Tzu kind of a dog named Chewbacca, and Chewbacca has had that surgery. And so when Chewbacca barks, he kind of goes,
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's the most horrible noise.
I mean, it's like they got this hairball they can't ever quite get out of the epiglottis. And my grandmother, who's all the talk about a woman that should have had several things severed and early and with extreme prejudice and painfully. She had her dog's vocal cords severed, and it's just like that was all that was the absolute proof that she was a horrible, loathsome, reprehensible woman, because the dog clearly didn't get what was going on. The dog's like, I don't know, I just can't seem to. I'm trying to get their attention. I don't know. Maybe if I just have a little. I don't know. Have you got a Halls or something with eucalyptus? Damn it! And it was like the 10 years the dog made that noise, and it was like. It was like if the dog was convinced it was somehow doing it wrong, like it had just forgotten how to bark or something. It was. I kept wanting to go like, nah, it's not you. They've put a little thing there. You're not going to be able to do that, you know?
I guess in some very rare situations, I could see that if you have a dog and the dog is just one of those breeds that won't start barking and you don't have any other option, you don't have anyone you can surrender the dog to, you don't want to take it to the Humane Society or wherever because you think it might be put down, even though they supposedly don't put them down at the Humane Society, but you get my point. But I guess, but most of the time, though, it seems like, yeah, it's one of those things that you're mutilating your dog because you have no business having a dog that barks where it is you're living. And so you're just going to basically, you know, destroy the dog's vocal cords for your convenience.
That being said, if you want to silence your child, I'm okay with that. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-5964. Coming up around the corner, we'll talk to Mr. Ryan White from the Oregonian. We'll also do today's Top 5. It is a continuation of Friday's Top 5. Dawn did her Top 5 soundtracks better than the movie that created them. I will do my own take on that. Taser Watch, Cheney Watch, Penis Watch, and the return of the Week in Geek. My God, that happens right now on the Rick Emerson radio program here on the Emerson News Network.
Greetings, programs. Aaron Duran here of geekinthecity.com announcing the triumphant return of the Week in Geek. And what a great way to start it off as we talk about Comic-Con, but not any great announcement, not any fantastic reveal. No, I'm here to talk about the douchebaggery that is Reverend Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, who have decided to turn their poison fangs onto, well, frankly, us. All through Comic-Con, a small enclave of the Westboro Baptist Church will be protesting Comic-Con with placards that read, "God hates nerds." In a related story, DC Comics has approved the sale of a t-shirt that says Superman loves fat.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
And speaking of power-hungry, condescending people that have visions of their own grandeur, it has also been reported that George Lucas has officially cut off all ties to David Prowse. The great flanneled one has sent an official and legal cease and desist letter to David Prowse that he is no longer to enter any Star Wars event that is officially sanctioned by Lucas, and it is with a heavy heart that David Prowse is no longer the official commander-in-chief of the 501st. And finally, in Portland, you still have a chance to pick up your own copy of Archives of the Fantastic, the 9th Cosmic Convergence, Portland's first and only 100% DIY homegrown live-action superhero movie put together by the Alter Ego Society. It's a great little 40-minute short film about defending the world with superheroes and villains. All profits go to the PAIR organization to help homeless youths get off the street. You can find out more at alteregosociety.com. I am Aaron Duran of geekinthecity.com, and this has been The Week in Geek.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for coming along and joining us on this Monday. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. If you want to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. I have this sneaking suspicion that all of my many failed auditions are, as we speak, probably being compiled and put into a hard drive for your personal amusement this holiday season, Don Taylor. That's just a theory, but I sense a great disturbance in the force. Something to do with me and my retarded, hillbilly Cajun stylings.
I think that the people would really love to see that.
Yes, well, I live to make the people happy. It's the Rick Emerson radio program coming up here in just a few moments. Welcome to the show, Mr. Ryan White from the Oregonian. We have today's top five coming up later on as well. A top five soundtracks that are better than the movie that created them. Dawn did her attempt at that list on Friday. I'll do mine today. We also have
there
is no definitive version. I'm saying it is like Pele said, no matter how good any game may be, there was always a better game to be played. So I'm saying that, I'm not saying that I have the final word on it either. Don't be defensive. You know what it is? You don't have to project onto me now simply because you inadvertently ruined my shot at fame and fortune on Friday with my audition for Leverage. My psyching me out over my headshot, my accent, my ability, my lack of any kind of acting talent whatsoever.
I have been nothing but supportive.
Let's see. Taser watch on the way. Cheney watch, a penis watch, and so forth. Oh, and our True Blood wrap-up. I totally forgot that. I don't even know why we're bothering to recap True Blood at this point, because all it is now is just a parade of absurdities.
Yeah. And somebody on the text box asked, no spoilers. And I'm like, what
spoilers?
It's ridiculous.
Okay, here's the thing.
How about that? That's all you have to do. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin anything, but the show sucks. It's terrible. I mean, I don't want to harsh your mellow or anything, but I mean, I've quashed all the excitement that you had planned for later on this week. It's not very good.
And Tara is still horrible.
Oh, God. I mean, you want to talk about somebody who just ought to be stricken with something debilitating and painful. I can't even, there are no words for how. I thought repeatedly, and it's like this ongoing tease where I thought we were going to be rid of that character.
You know? I swear, this actress, though, this is going to be like me with Mark Blucas on Buffy.
Ugh.
Every time I see her now forever in anything she's in, I'm just going to go, ah, Tara.
Well, because, Mark Blucas is the, and he's the guy who played Riley on season 4 of Buffy, am I right?
Yes.
And what did you call him? Riley the Load?
Riley the Load.
I mean, there's just no getting around it. I mean, truer words were never spoken. The guy's just a waste. I mean, he's basically just like a plant with eyes that they sort of, he is what, he is what Joni DeRoshi would call a talking prop, you know? Not really able to act as such, but if you kind of put him in a room, and ask him to say some lines, he can probably do it, and he'll pronounce a plurality of the words correctly, and that's sort of enough. But the thing is that the Tara on True Blood, it's sort of approaching like full-on Michelle Rodriguez proportions, where I may at some point have to just pull the ripcord and quit watching the show because of her. At least that mom of hers is not on the screen all the time. You know, and that, what was her boyfriend's name? Eggs.
Eggs.
I mean, it's, and, well, now we're just doing the recap, so we'll have to wait. We'll have to put a pin in it for a second. Let's do this. Let's pay a visit to the news desk. We'll get a couple of headlines here, and then we'll welcome Mr. Ryan White to the program. Ladies and gentlefolk, will you please give your attention to Dawn Taylor?
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Employees at Southeast Portland's Frankie's Franks say their 6-foot hot dog costume disappeared from the restaurant on Southeast 82nd Avenue sometime Saturday. The hot dog costume was being painted so it could appear at Park Rose High School's Funorama Festival. But employees said someone nabbed it when the painter walked away for a 5-minute break.
Here's the great thing about that, is that implies that somebody was like, they were casing the joint, that they were... I know, casing the sausage. But they were like laying in wait. You know what I mean?
I think it was just a crime of opportunity. Someone walked by and went, hey, free hot dog suit.
But how would you... No, because you can't... There's no... It's a large suit. It's suit-sized. It's man-sized. How tall is it? I mean, I would say it's a good 6 feet.
It's 6 feet tall, 40 pounds, and brown.
Wait, but it's not...
They
it's not
said,
like,
just like a hot dog.
It's not... Okay, first of all... It's not like a thing you can just put in your back pocket. It's not like you can see a man-sized hot dog outfit and decide to stash it, where normally your pocket watch or something would
go, but
just take it home.
It's also like made out of foam rubber, so it doesn't weigh a lot. So if you were walking down the street and you saw this hot dog suit just laying there, you could conceivably pick it up and just scamper off with it really quick.
I do like the idea of the guy's thought balloon actually saying, hey, free hot dog suit, and just sticking it, which is a great phrase. It seems like the name of a Captain Beefheart album or something. I'm just sort of going, well, why not? Which I guess would be the same sort of male cultural imperative that drives guys to steal, like, sawhorses with blinking construction lights on them and, mm-hmm. like, yield signs and whatnot. So, well, fair enough. Back to let's welcome out of the Rick Emerson program, and I hope I'm on the right mic here. Ryan White from the Oregonian. Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you on this fine Monday?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. Do me a favor. Push that windscreen a little bit closer to the mic there so that you, in turn, actually, no, down. Yeah, there we go.
All right. There we go.
Let me just ask you this.
Maybe.
If I were to ask you to describe the physical appearance, and I'm not speaking in euphemism, I'm not really talking about anything else. If I were to ask you to describe the physical appearance of a hot dog, not like with the bun and whatever, just the actual cylindrical object itself, what would you say it looks like?
Brownish. Okay,
I was listening to this last bit though, and what I'm thinking about is, was there a police sketch done of it? And I would love, and that would answer your question right there.
Have you seen
audio.
This man? Just like a huge hot dog.
Yeah.
Where are you buying your hot dogs that they're brown?
Ish.
Ish. I mean, but that's not brown.
I have a hot dog.
That
right
is
here.
Not brown.
It is. It's a pinkish brown. Okay. That is brown.
Okay.
My friend.
Okay, this table is brown. Dirt is brown.
Look, it's like the same color as the table. It's brown.
I cannot believe you're just putting a hot dog on our table. God, that's revolting. I cannot believe you just took a hot dog out of the bag and you're just sticking it. Do you know what happens on this table when we're not here?
Oh,
do you know
I
what happens
know.
To hot dogs?
Yeah. No, touche. That's a fair point.
I had one out at the zoo concert last week, and all I could think of is, what could possibly go into a hot dog at the zoo?
I don't know. Didn't you used to have five zebras? I guess putting it on this table makes it a bit of a wash. So that is not. I wish I had like a color swatch.
Hold on.
Does Crayola have something for this?
No.
Crayola.com.
No. You know who does? Apple Computer does, and it's called a. I have a palette. Here.
A hot dog color app?
No, but you know what? But if I pull up brown on my word processor here. Look, colors. Okay, here's my color wheel. All right. Now, I have pulled up pink and brown over here. And I'm telling you right now, hot dog ain't no brown. Bring that over here. Don't hand me, for the love of God, woman, put it in a bag or something.
Just throw it.
Just handing me a hot dog.
Here.
You don't even like to hug people. You're handing me meat. All right.
Well, I didn't want to handle your meat.
Wah, wah. I'm sorry. Let me just... I haven't even used this since we moved over here. Hold on a second. Where the hell is my... Where the hell is my bad joke sounder? I don't... Oh, I can't believe this. Are you telling me that my bad joke sound is gone somewhere? That's almost certainly not it. I have no idea. Oh, man, you know, I am just full of the most abject failure on that front. All right, now I got to load that back on here. All right, let me just look here. Okay, I got my color palette thing here. All right, this is, I would say, this is somewhere in the neighborhood of, wait, I'm scrolling through all of the colors. I would say that this hot dog is somewhere between salmon and improbably enough carnation, although I would say closer to salmon.
Hey, you're crazy. It is definitely a pinkish brown, but it's, and then they become even more brown when they're cooked.
And there is no element of brown in this, is the thing that I'm saying. There's no
element of natural color in there is the problem.
My kingdom for a camera. I of course failed to bring. All right, I got to take a photo of this later and put it up. You have a camera, Ryan White? All right.
Someone on the text box says, how about tan? Can you at least acknowledge that a hot dog might be tan?
No, because to say that it's tan is to say, do you need me to turn on the overhead light? I'll do it. All right. To say that it's tan is to say that it's like a taupe or a sand color, and that's not the case. I mean, really, the top of this table is a tan color. It's sort of a beige tan.
I'd call it more sandy.
This is, in fact, a salmon color. There is no hint of brown in this
salmon
at all.
Salmon is much pinker than hot dog color.
I will acknowledge this isn't like a fluorescent pink. It's not like a, it's not, you know, it's not like, it's not Barbie pink. I'm just saying it's not brown in any way, shape, matter, function, or form. All right, I'm going to hand your hot, cannot believe we're passing a hot dog back and forth.
Realize this
studio.
Is my lunch. By the way,
well, that's
this raw hot dog.
Well, that's not my fault. And I'm not. I was rolling it around on furniture in the studio. All right. Have we done any actual news here? All right. We did the hot dog.
We were also going to ask Ryan White his opinion because you also would not acknowledge that a hot dog is a sausage.
Okay. Yeah. Would you acknowledge? Okay. Do you believe a hot dog to be a sausage?
It's got to be in the sausage family.
That's kind of a weasel word answer.
Well,
though.
Yeah, it is.
You're splitting the difference there.
And I say this as somebody who's eaten more than his share of these in press boxes and stadiums, and just in general, you got to put it somewhere. I don't necessarily believe it a sausage. But
and if you go to Wikipedia, it does say a hot dog, Frankfurter Wiener, is a moist sausage of soft, even texture and flavor.
Then what?
I don't. Well,
it's in a casing. It is ground up meat in a casing. It's a sausage.
Let me suggest, though, that there are different hot dogs, because you can go to a butcher shop and get the good hot dogs that are in a casing that are definitely a sausage. That, not so much a casing. That seems to have been like plastic injection molded into...
Hot dogs by Mattel. So let me ask you this then. If a hot dog is a sausage, Don Taylor,
yes.
How do you know... Why do you call that a hot dog? I mean, how do you know a hot dog when you see it? What are the in other words, they must not be the same thing or you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. They would not have defining characteristics.
No, sausage is basically the genus.
Hot dog. I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say genus.
Well, come on. There are hot dogs / frankfurters. You've got your kielbasa and smoked sausages. You've got breakfast sausages. You've got bratwurst. I mean, those are all sausages.
All right. I am, by the way, I'm glad you didn't say phylum, because genus is funnier than phylum. No. Let's move on. Let's do like one more here, and then we'll find out what's going on in the world of Ryan White.
Okay. Let's do our taser watch. I'm excited to do our taser watch today.
It's all very complicated. All right. By the way,
just eat my hot dog for a
just
second.
Are you really? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me for the love of sweet Jehovah? Are you effing kidding me?
What?
You just ate a hot dog.
It touched the table. It was briefly on the table.
Oh, I swear
to
God.
And then you handled it with a piece of paper. It's not like you had your hands all
over
it.
You know that this table, first of all, let's...
I don't think that strippers have been rolling around on this table. I mean, it's possible, but I don't think so.
Leave aside the fact that Sarah's drunken friend Tuggy had his meaty paws all over the table last week after probably scratching himself in some inappropriate place. You know, not that he's not a good guy and all. Leave aside the fact. I mean, let's just think of the people who. No offense, right? The people who have sat in that chair and just, you know, they put their big mitts up on the table. Do you realize?
I have a very strong immune system.
You know, this table came from the basement of an office liquidators, where it just sat like the Ark of the Covenant for like 80 years.
Well, we cleaned it, didn't we?
Maybe you cleaned it. If by we you mean myself or Greg, that would be no. It was all I could do to lift the goddamn thing and to get it up here.
You guys brought this thing in here and you didn't clean the top off of it?
No, you know why I didn't feel compelled to clean the top? Because I lifted it because because I paid for it, and B, because Greg and I then gave ourselves multiple hernias trying to get it. It's not easy getting this table. This table weighs like 1,000 pounds, getting it up these stairs. These legs on this table don't come off, by the way. They are welded on.
But that doesn't preclude spraying something on the top of it and wiping it down.
It does if you're busy fighting off some kind of thrombosis because you were trying to navigate the thing up these windy stairs. I'm sorry I didn't stop to clean the table while I was fighting off a cardiac arrest.
Well, it seems remarkably clean, so it didn't occur to me that you had never bothered to, like, clean it after bringing it apparently from hobo hell or wherever you brought it from, that it's so covered with bacteria.
I think it didn't occur to me to clean it because it didn't occur to me to use it as a plate, to be... You know, some folks... You know, it's like Randall McMurphy says, when he's cleaning the toilets. Some folks plan to eat out of them, nurse. Me, myself, I plan to pee in it. So, you know, I'm just saying. All right, let's take a break here. Just a figurative break. Just a moment of zen here so that our new sponsor does not be back to back with my discussion of Randall McMurphy and hot dogs and toilets. Let's just find something soothing to play in the interim. No, it's not that. So it's no.
One big fiesta for illegal aliens and homosexuals.
I don't know where any of my soothing sounds went. Oh, there we go. All right. Okay. It's a very exciting time in the Rick Emerson radio program. If you heard last hour's Legion of News, you heard us welcome a brand new sponsor to the show. And in fact, that is one of two proud partners that joins us today, part of the Rick Emerson Revolution, bringing entertainment to the masses, whether they want it or not. We actually have a second business that has come on board today. That's right. Two businesses, one day, no waiting. And it really is. It's the most glorious thing, too. I mean... people I've been interviewed over the years about the show and in its various incarnations and through various firings and from one unpleasantness to the next, and this is all stuff we've talked about so many times, I guess, for both good and bad, that every time we get fired there's this group of folks that just sticks with us. I think maybe just out of habit or inertia or something at this point. I mean, because the gaps just seem to be longer and longer. You know, maybe I'll be unemployed for 9 months this time. But And a lot of those folks have businesses themselves. So it is with the cleaning solution and our good friend Michael, about whom we will talk more in a bit. And so it is with mugshotlist.com. And I have to tell you, here's the thing about there's like five things you got to know about mugshotlist.com before we get to the Taser Watch, of whom they are a sponsor, of which they are a sponsor, of which he. There's a whole pronoun thing going on, but you know what I'm saying. You get the gist here. The things you need to know about Mugshot List are these. First of all, our executive producer, Bruce Agler, thinking, I believe, that this was some sort of dating site, kept referring to Mugshot List as mugshotlist.com. And he kept saying, so we got this second advertiser, this Mugs Hot List. They start on Monday. Have you got the copy points for that? And I said, for who? What are you talking about? And he goes, you know, an advertiser, the Mugs Hot List. And he said, like, waving his arms around like a T-Rex. And I said, but do you mean Mugshot List? And then he did the greatest thing of, like, holding the paperback and peering kind of, you know, down as though over spectacles and saying, oh, Mugshot List, yes. So mugshotlist.com, and it is a site operated, owned, and run by a listener of ours named Andy. They cover 19 counties in Oregon, 13 states, including Georgia, Texas, Ohio, and, of course, what state, Dawn Taylor?
Florida.
That's right, Florida. They are always adding more counties and states, and they are the world's finest collection of mugshots. You can find them at mugshotlist.com, locally owned, locally operated, and the proud sponsor of the Taser Watch. They are mugshotlist.com, or Mugs Hot List if you prefer. This Taser Watch, sponsored by mugshotlist.com. That's fantastic. That's really what Guglielmo was thinking when he invented the radio. This is Dawn Taylor with your Taser Watch.
A 36-year-old man was shocked with a taser on Saturday after allegedly throwing knives at police officers near Dos Palos, California, according to the Merced County Sheriff's Department. The incident was reported around 3:20 p.m. Residents had called 911 about a man who was behaving strangely. Witnesses said the man, Dennis Covington, had lit a broom on fire and was trying to ignite a hot water heater located inside an outdoor closet at the home.
There's a whole bunch of things that don't go together in the story. None of these things, none of these components fit together.
Two Dos Palos police officers arrived at the scene, but Covington climbed on top of the single-story home's roof. Police noticed Covington was armed with two kitchen knives and tried talking him off the roof. Covington, who was standing about 30 to 50 feet away from the officers, ignored their requests and threw both knives at them. Goen said one officer fired his gun twice at Covington but missed. After the officers called for backup, sheriff's deputies and California Highway Patrol officers responded to the scene. Covington remained on the roof for about a half an hour and tried hiding from the view of law enforcement during the incident.
I wonder if he tried hiding from view just by sort of, I mean, was he, he was trying to set the water heater on fire, but the water heater was where? It was down on the ground?
Yeah, and then when they came after him, he climbed up on the roof of his house.
Okay, so it wasn't like he was sort of hiding behind the water heater.
No, I'm imagining if he's on a single-story roof, he was probably trying to hide behind, like, the chimney something. Where are you going to hide?
I'm picturing the crazy guy hiding, which is sort of like the ferocious bug bladder beast of Trall, which is where, you know, the cover, you know.
Just cover your eyes. It assumes
if you can't see it, it can't see you. I'm just imagining this guy like trying to hide behind the broom or something. You know, his grasp of spatial relations maybe not being quite as crackerjack as some.
Eventually, Covington jumped off the roof and tried fleeing from the officers. After he began to run, he was shot with a taser by a sheriff's deputy and taken into custody.
It's so great that he jumped off the roof, and you don't just jump off the roof and immediately go into a sprint. That's where you hit the ground, you crumple for a second, you stand back up, and you run. And it's great that they waited until he started to run just to sort of like, I wonder if there was like some sort of a low-key wager being placed on that.
Giving him a sporting chance, really.
Or if it was just kind of a moving target bet, you know what I mean? You know, who's going to pay for gas? And let me see if I can hit him at 10 paces when he's running. Bam! And then, sure enough, I wonder if cops will just message each other, like text each other something, when they kind of get a sense there's going to be a tasing. You know what I mean? I would do, like, if, in other words, you know, like if Ryan's a cop and you're a cop,
right.
You guys are working a few blocks away. If he's getting ready to tase a guy, especially a guy who, like, richly deserves it in some way, you know, like a guy throwing knives at you, I mean, you'd want to know, right? Like, you'd want him to say, like, hey, FYI, tasing in 5 minutes over at 5th and Alder. Be there, right?
Yeah. There's probably a police code for it.
That's a good point. I bet
just
there
put
is.
Put it out over the radio.
I bet there is a police code for tasing imminent. Tasing about to happen. Or
and then
like,
they just drop everything and speed over there.
Well, you know, because all kinds of absolutely, hell yeah. I mean, look, in my opinion, officers deserve to get whatever perks they can, whether it's some chick who puts out because she likes guys in a uniform or whether it's seeing a guy get tased. Doesn't matter. You know, if you're going to risk getting shot for not a whole lot of money, sometimes the scorn of an uncaring liberal community. By God, you deserve to see a recreational tasing every now and again. I'm all for that. And all businesses have they have secret like codes, you know, that they use to express things that they don't want the public to know about, but to convey information. You know that cops do. I mean, I will guarantee you that cops have secret acronyms or phrases or code words that they'll use so that they can have conversations about things over the radio or in the presence of civilians. And I bet you my bottom dollar that one of those things is like, I'm going to tase a guy who really has it coming. You should get over here and also bring me a coffee.
Well, Covington did injure himself after jumping from the roof and was taken to the hospital for treatment. Additional knives were discovered on the roof and on the ground.
Well done, sir. There you go. There's your Taser Watch, sponsored by MugshotList.com, right here on the Rick Emerson Show. Fantastic. Let's do. No, and it can't be stopped. Ah, good God Almighty. That's got a mind of its own there for a second. Let's do one more here, and then we will talk to Ryan White about the Oregonian and all things related thereto.
President Barack Obama welcomed the WNBA champion Phoenix Mercury to the White House on Monday. The team recently won their second WNBA championship in 3 years. Mr. Obama says the team is a great example for his young daughters.
As a basketball fan, I congratulate you on your second championship. As a father, I thank you for being great role models.
The team recently won their second WNBA championship in the past 3 years.
Congratulations to the Phoenix Mercury on winning your second WNBA title in the last 3 years.
I know it's wrong of me to feel this way, but that just seems emasculating. The president shouldn't have to. He shouldn't have to be nice to people from the WNBA. That just seems. You know. That's just one of those. I mean, first of all, because you're standing next to a woman who's like 9 feet tall, and I don't care because Obama's a tall man, isn't he? He's like 6'3". You're standing next to somebody from the WNBA, you just look like a midget.
They're women, so they're only a little bit.
No,
they're regular sized, most of them.
They're regular sized. Pardon me.
I mean, they're tall.
I covered the WNBA for a year.
Is it Rick? Is the only what is the Portland WNBA team?
There isn't one anymore. They got rid of that years ago.
Really?
Well,
when did that happen?
Don was reading that. I was thinking, I just missed an entire WNBA season. I wasn't.
That's what I mean. It's so hard for me to talk about the I'm going to say that I don't know a lot about sports, as you know. But it's so hard for me to talk about the WNBA without sounding snarky. But I've learned that that is a problem that everyone has.
Yeah.
That is a universal problem. So, like, immediately when I see, you know, I mean, look, he's the most powerful man in the world. He is the leader of the planet. He is the most, arguably the most important human on Earth at this time. My first thought is, God, I'm standing next to people from the WNBA. God, that's just embarrassing. I feel so bad for him. You know, he's got first strike capability. You know, he could have me killed if he wanted. But, you know, that's not what comes to mind. I have found that it is a common lament among people that they find themselves incapable of discussing the WNBA without sounding somehow snarky or dismissive or whatever.
Yeah.
But you just noted that, like, you just missed an entire season of that. Here's a dumb question. So, you know, you're music editor at the Oregonian, but you're a sports writer for a long time and a big sports enthusiast. Does the WNBA make any money?
No. I mean, they went a couple of years ago, and this is when Portland lost its team. They decided it was centrally owned within the league, operated by basically, you know, the entirety of the NBA. It's, you know, One of the problems with the league is that it exists solely to put bodies in arenas in the summer. It did originally. It's changed now, and it's gone to some private ownership. And there are probably some teams that are making some money. I bet, like, the team in Connecticut, which I'm sure draws well because of the way that the University of Connecticut's women's basketball team does, they probably do okay. Others are, you know, they're probably tax write-offs for NBA owners.
What was the team we had here?
The Portland Fire.
The Fire, that's right. There was two of the Fire players were at the, I don't know, maybe like, they might have been at the Country Station or something. And it was like that Futurama episode where they land on the Snoo-Snoo planet. It was like just walking into a wall of woman. I mean, I felt like, I really just felt like Ted Raimi all of a sudden. It was all very unsettling.
The really great thing about covering them, though, was as opposed to, you know, and it's not true of all NBA players or all professional male athletes, but they had all gone to college, and they had all gone to college for something real because
right.
It wasn't a really legitimate. You weren't going to get
not going to make $1 billion in the WNBA.
So they were really interesting people to talk to. I mean, Sonja Henning, who played in the WNBA and the team that Portland had before it was a WNBA team. I mean, she's on the school board now, but she had a labor law degree from Duke during the time of the last NBA lockout, and we would sit around and she would explain to me the labor issues going on. I mean, just a really smart person who was a really good athlete. You know, as the father of a daughter now, I'm really glad it exists, but I'm also glad that I don't have to watch it yet.
You don't have to sit there in the stands taking notes. I don't mean to be Alan Alda about this, but that's the thing. So look, it's not like I got something against the female athletes, you know, at all. It does seem to be specific to the WNBA. I don't know what that's all about.
It was designed as an afterthought by the NBA to make money from parking and concessions in the summer. So it originated as an afterthought.
Is that why it gets, and I'm including myself in this, is that why it's the butt of so many jokes? Because it did not emerge organically because it was either seen as or was in point of fact kind of a contrivance at the beginning? Is that why it doesn't get any respect?
A little bit. Some of it's just general, you know,
jackassery.
Jackassery and sexist rambling by people like me.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I think chicks who could pummel me into dust are hot. I mean, there's just no getting around that. If you could have me destroyed either physically or financially, I find it a big turnoff.
The WNBA has a real design flaw too, in that it's jammed into the summer months, whereas the league that it put out of business, the ABL, they did it during regular basketball. During the regular basketball season, so the games were spaced out. There was practice time. A lot of the WNBA players play over in Europe and then rush back here, and they play 30-some-odd games jammed into 40-some-odd days, and it's physically taxing. It hurts the product. It's not as good a product as you could have if somebody really meant it.
I was going to ask two questions. Sort of springboard out of my...
I had no idea we were going to be discussing the WNBA when I came in here today. I would have done some homework.
Get in line.
It's not a very nice thing, but someone on the text box did just say, chicks that could pummel Rick encompasses about 80% of all women.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What was my point? Oh, so two things sort of springboarded in my head. One, whatever happened to arena football? They still play that?
They went out of business for a year. They might be back. I mean, if a league where Jon Bon Jovi's an owner can't make it, I don't know if I want to live in that world.
I mean, that was one of those things that I got turned on to because of David Letterman. Letterman was so into arena football. I'm like, well, I got to give it a try. And it was like they just found these guys like working at a dock somewhere. And they're like, you want to play football? And they went, all right. And then they just went. And they, as you said, like in the downtime and in the offseason, they would just go play. And it was fantastic.
I was at Jazz Fest down in New Orleans 2 years ago, and Bon Jovi was like the Saturday headliner the second weekend, and we just decided to swing by over to see the size of the crowd and hoping to hear one good song, and we got over there, and it was like some of the mid-90s, mid-tempo crap.
Something from my solo album. Not that one.
But I look up, and I'm standing right behind a guy in a Philadelphia Soul Bon Jovi Arena League football jersey, and I'm just like, wow. And my wife is looking at me like, what does all of that mean? And I'm like, we don't have enough time. Well, we'll wait for the cab ride back to the French Quarter.
So many layers of weird. Who is it that I saw that owns part of an arena football team and then part of an actual major sport franchise? It's Freedom Williams from CNC Music Factory. And I can't remember what the hell it is. I think it's like an NBA team or something. I can't remember. I'll have to look it up now. But Freedom Williams from CNC Music Factory owns part of some team somewhere, but then I think, you know, has, you know, recently divested himself of part of that in order to fund you know, like an arena football purchase of some kind. So I guess, yeah, it must be it's either back or about to be back. And then And then I wanted somebody right now to be making this sort of made for ESPN. Because, you know, an art form that we have really perfected in the last 10, 15 years in this country is the made for television biopic or docudrama. Mm-hmm. And I think VH1 and HBO together are the ones who really did it. Because HBO with like The Late Shift and your Barbarians at the Gate, and then VH1 with all of those like the Beach Boys movie and the Partridge Family movie and the Def Leppard movie. I want somebody to do one of those about the rise and fall of the XFL, which was just the greatest and worst idea, like all at once. I remember at the time, and I'm glad it was not available to me, saying, this is the best idea ever. I would buy stock in this company right now. Do you remember the XFL, Dunn?
The actual team for Los Angeles, their practice field was in my hometown, Manhattan Beach, which is south of L.A., and I had a job once, or I tried as a teenager, selling season tickets for arena football for XFL.
I think you could really only try that for one season.
And first of all, I was no good at telemarketing, and I didn't want to get good at it because I was surrounded by guys that's all they had ever done. And I'd go home at night and I'd have that cadence in my voice that I'd be talking like those guys. Yeah, and it was just like no one wanted them. I had to call. I spent the days calling dentists and trying to explain dentists that season tickets to XFL would be awesome to take like their clients and stuff, and no one wanted
them. And that's just
them.
A lie. You're just peddling falsehoods there.
Yeah.
I mean, did you even get past the F in XFL before? Hello? Can I just?
Yeah, just gonna go away. Just leave me alone.
God damn. All I remember was that they had that weird camera like on a bungee cord or something that swung down the middle of the field. But I remember reading like, the guy who runs the then WWF is going to start a football league. This is going to be this can't miss. And it just missed like spectacularly. The only thing anybody remembers from the XFL is that camera and that guy whose name was He Hate Me. That's it. That is
And nobody
it.
Knows his real name.
No. No, like
I hope he's changed it. His real name officially to He Hate Me.
No, you know it's called it's pronounced Hehatame. Pardon me, Mr. Hehatame, you need a small business loan? I'm sorry. No. I want somebody to track down that guy though. I want to, like, where is he right now? What is he doing?
That can't be that hard.
No,
it's the internet.
He's got to be doing something.
Let's see, shall we?
Now, see, but you're going to do it, and it's going to turn out to be something that is either...
Just try Twitter /He Hate Me and see if anybody's doing it.
You should, and if somebody isn't, you should do that
Rod
right now.
Rod Smart, a professional, former professional American football player in the NFL.
Also a professional former player.
Yeah. He's probably best known for his Outlaws jersey name, He Hate Me.
He might.
Probably. I think you can take that qualifier off that sentence.
Might also be known for curing polio.
He currently lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, and works with high school students as a counselor.
Oh, I wonder if that means working off a community service of some kind. That's typically what that means.
Wouldn't you love to like get in a high school fight and be dragged in to see your counselor and he hate me?
Pardon me, Mr. Me. I'm supposed to come see you.
About my anger management issues?
It's like, well, whenever, like, you see the end of a movie and they're, like, going through the band or whoever it is and, you know, they're doing the Where Are They Now, you know, and the so-and-so went on to sell, it's like with the Runaways, you know, Joan went on to sell 13 million records, blah, 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 and Lita Ford, although I think Lita Ford actually wasn't even mentioned at the end, but, you know, but then they note, what's her name, Cherie Curry and, you know, currently lives in Los Angeles, and it's, you know, or whatever, and it's, you know,
and she's a chainsaw artist.
And is a chainsaw artist. That's right.
I got pitched that interview on the chainsaw artist part when that movie was coming out. Yeah.
And did you take it?
No, I was too busy. I should have.
Oh yeah. I mean, seriously.
It was one of those things that I didn't have time to do it, and two, didn't have any place to put it.
So, I know someone who shall remain nameless, but who is widely known to this audience, who went into Jason Crump told me this. It wasn't him, by the way. Photographer extraordinaire Jason Crump told me this story because he was the one who shot the he took pictures of the interview. Somebody who was widely known to the audience of the Rick Emerson Show sat down to interview her and right out of the gate just blew things by calling her Cherry. And so you never recover from that.
No,
that's a thing that'll stay with you. Next time you're trying to perform as a man, you'll remember that moment. All right. Well, in any event. I don't even know what we were doing. Let's do. Do we have a Darwin watch to get to?
Yes, we do. We have a Cheney watch, a Darwin watch, a penis watch. Pick your poison,
sir. Too much happening. We got to do the Darwin watch.
Okay.
And then we got to get this top five and True Blood. Some of the watches may have to just.
So many things to do.
So much going on. All right. So that's all. That is all coming. By the way, before we plunge on into any of this, what is coming up in the Oregonian that folks don't know about?
We're on vacation this week, so just it means we're updating the blog regularly. I just put up a review of Saturday night's Avett Brothers show over at OregonLive.com.
And how was that?
I made what might be, and I say this at the beginning, I understand the gravity of the comparison, and I hedge it a little by saying a little like, but I kind of think seeing the Avett Brothers right now might be, in terms of the way they approach a live show and the intensity of it and the way that they can move a crowd.
Wait, hold on. Don't say it. I'm going to say, finish his comparison, Tom. What are you thinking he said?
Early Springsteen?
That's me too.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Late 70s, early 80s Springsteen, probably. All right.
The Avett Brothers are awesome.
It was,
they really are.
I've seen four shows this year that made me want to like be better at what I do. And that was the fourth of them, and it was the same. I took a friend to we went up to Seattle with me and Jim Brunberg, who's the co-owner of Mississippi Studios,
right,
in 2008 to see Springsteen after the Portland show. And Brian had never seen Springsteen, and we ended up, you know, right in the very front of his microphone for the night. And afterwards, Brian just looks at me and goes, "I feel like I want to call my mom and tell her that I love her."
It's fantastic. You'd called "I Am Lovin' You" the best record of the year, and my is there "I and You in Love"? What is it?
"I Am Lovin' You."
"I Am Lovin' You." And my brother had been nagging me to listen for the longest time. He's like, "I got the best thing you got to hear." You know, and the thing is, it's not that he has bad taste in music. It's just that many things he's really into, I don't necessarily cotton to. It's not that they're bad. It's just not, he will be over the moon about something, and it'll sort of just, you know, I'll be a little bit indifferent. Like the Black Keys, one of those groups, where he was really, really into the Black Keys. Nothing wrong with them. They don't really push any of my buttons the same way they do with him. So he was all over those guys, the Avett Brothers. And I was like, yeah, Avett, Schmavett, I got stuff to listen to over here. You know, I got, you know, and I'm just going back to my Alice Cooper box set for like the millionth time or whatever. And then when you came on the show and made that announcement, he just sent me this, you know, he's like, sure, when the Oregonian guy tells you to listen to it, you listen to it. But but that is one of those things where you, you know, everybody else was clearly like, you know, certainly way ahead of me. And you were ahead of most folks on that, you and him, because it was long before I started reading about them, you know, everywhere. I had only sort of heard
of them, and I saw them down at Jazz Fest and, you know, was just blown away there. And then you start digging back, and as much as I love "I and Loving You," I understand completely why, you know, the people that have been onto them for a while really revere the earlier records. There's a little less polished and a little wilder in there, but I mean, it's just a tremendous, tremendous live show. And it was, you know, Edgefield's a place where people are predisposed to lean back on their blankets,
right,
and drink their Terminator and say, "My, what a lovely evening this is." And people were on their feet for pretty much the entire show, most of the crowd.
And venues like that are hard because it's like that energy can just sort of dissipate.
Yeah.
You can just kind of, you can just sort of lose it. What did I see there that I felt like it was sort of the wrong? Well, I saw Death Cab for Cutie there, and I'm not like a huge fan of those guys,
mm-hmm,
but it just felt like certain bands, the energy just needs to be contained, and it needs to stay in the room and in the crowd, especially if it's a music that is sort of intimate or emotionally connective in some way, because otherwise it just sort of floats up into the
ether.
Some
bands need walls.
It's gone. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like.
Well, I was just reading a short story by Steve Almond, and he was describing, based on a lot of his old rock journalism stuff, and he described going to a show at an outdoor festival with Bon Jovi, and that it just seemed wrong.
Yeah.
There were just all these people with picnic blankets all spread out, and John Bon Jovi seemed to know it as soon as he walked out on stage with his hair frizzing in the humidity, and all these people just, you know.
Yeah.
Lounging about, and him just going, yeah, hi.
And the thing about the Avetts, I mean, they're the kind of band that if they walked out and they saw that, and people were on their feet from the moment they walked out anyways, but you get the idea that they would work harder,
right?
Because of that. They wouldn't just lay back. And you know, you mentioned Steve Almond. His new book is, he's really great when it comes to rock writing, but his new book, Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, is great. Anybody who like reveres music and spends hours trying to figure out what you should play with the right dinner, you know, who matches music with meals the way some people match wine, will understand it completely.
And that's the book I'm reading right now.
Excellent.
By sheer coincidence.
All of the stuff there. So we'll roll into into these watches here in a second, and we will we'll get to our top five as well. We're here with Ryan White from the Oregonian. I do want to take this moment, ladies and gentlefolk. I mentioned that we had. I'm sort of doing this backward, but if you heard Legion News earlier today, you heard us talk about a brand new sponsor here on the Rick Emerson radio program, standing shoulder to shoulder with ye in supporting this fine cavalcade of whimsy and amusements. The cleaning solution, which as Don Taylor noted, no more than 5 or 6 minutes after the fact, is in fact a play on words. A guy named Michael Beatty runs the cleaning solution. It is his business. He is the owner, the operator, the proprietor, and a good guy. And I'm going to give you the phone number right now, and I'll give it to you again here at the end. It's 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. And what they basically say is that anything you walk on, they can clean. And, you know, that stuff all requires, or this table, for example. Seriously, we ought to have him come in here and do one of those things, first of all, where he, like, scans it with, like, some CSI thing to see exactly.
Sprays it with luminol and then brings out the blue light.
What if he did and it was just covered with blood? I mean, what if it, in the shape of a pentagram?
I would still not regret having eaten that hot dog.
I'd regret having him do the test, frankly. I wouldn't regret buying the table, though. I'd just be glad I got it so cheaply. Anyway, moving on from pentagrams and blood. He probably does. I mean, look, we ought to have him on. I want to know, like, the weirdest thing he's ever gotten out of a carpet. Because, you wonder if you're a guy like this, where it's like he's doing. I mean, I'll listen. He says, stain removal from carpet, upholstery, stone, marble, tile. And he says, if you walk on it, we can take care of it. You got, every now and again, there's got to be somebody who says, look, it's not what it seems like. But I got a huge pool of blackened, steaming blood in my entryway. And some holes in the wall. Now, don't worry about the holes. I'll fix those. But this walkway, it's got to be cleaned by 4 p.m. this afternoon. I mean, earlier. I'll pay you more. Anyway, so I don't even know what I was talking about. But the point is,
I think you turned him into the wolf from Pulp Fiction.
Well, look, I mean, if you had a rug that needed cleaning and you had your choice of that guy, or, I mean,
you need to get brains out of the backseat of your car.
Moving on, the cleaning solution, Michael Beatty is his name. The phone number is 971-533-3211. But I was talking earlier about, you know, I got this dog, God bless him, but he's figured out how to levitate or hover or something, and how to get things off the counter and then drag them to the house and destroy my carpet, and, you know, and to make sure that every fiber has some sort of, you know, tomato sauce ground into it. So pet damage or odor repair, and Michael, the owner of the cleaning solution, actually has a bunch of dogs himself, so he knows exactly what he's dealing with there. Locally owned, locally operated, and I was talking to him this morning. He's a great guy and a proud supporter of the Rick Emerson Show, so do give him a call and let him know that he will be the first call for all your cleaning needs for everything you might walk on. The cleaning solution, Michael is his name, and the number is 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Once more, ladies and gentlefolk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
We have a Darwin Watch.
Here is your Darwin Watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I have a feeling some bad stuff is about to go down.
Here is Don Taylor with your Darwin Watch.
One man died and three others were injured in an explosion on the central Oregon coast this weekend. The deadly blast occurred at 8 p.m. Saturday night in the community of Seal Rock, which is between Newport and Walport. Lincoln County deputies say it appears that 38-year-old Eric Jason Rose of Kaiser was one of several people who were trying to load a black powder cannon device, which belonged to the property owner. The cannon exploded, sending shredded metal fragments flying in all directions.
And the best part is how it appears as though that may be what killed them. It could have been natural causes or emphysema or something. It might have been, though, the cannon that exploded into a series of metallic shreds.
One of those fragments killed Rose. The three other men were injured, but only one of them seriously enough to be taken by ambulance to a hospital in Newport. Deputies contacted the Lincoln County District Attorney's Office for possible action. They also contacted the county medical examiner. The case remains under investigation.
What is there to investigate? Well, okay, I guess many things. First of all, is it an actual cannon or is it a cannon-like device? What was the actual phrase?
They said a black powder cannon-like device.
Okay, that's like crusted
cannon,
clown's
well, actually,
gum-like
it's a
substance.
Cannon device.
Cannon device. Okay, it's either a cannon or it's a cannon device. If it's a cannon, you would just say it's a cannon. This implies that it's basically something tubular that they found and stuck into the ground, and then they just like loaded it up with, I don't know, whatever. Ryan, you're a reporter. Anything?
Silverware, marbles, jacks. I'm imagining that scene from Pirates of the Caribbean where they're throwing like everything that they can into the cannon.
God, I mean, I can't even imagine if you went to the trouble to get a lot of black powder, first of all. I don't know where you get black powder. I mean, is that the thing, like, where if you're a guy who, like, reloads his own ammunition or something, that you could buy it by the bag? Or, in other words,
uncap your shotgun shells? And
maybe. I mean, it's like you go into a lot of effort, is my point, to get that black powder. It's not like you can just go get it at the Safeway. So you would think that a little care would go into getting something that isn't going to, you know, blow apart and, you know, and just sort of eviscerate your internal organs. I mean, so it would seem to me. I mean, I'm not – maybe they do things different in Seal Rock. Maybe that's their way. Maybe it's a cultural tradition there. I just don't know.
Yeah, I think the local pirate reenactors should take this to heart, though, and be careful.
Seriously.
Because you know they're probably playing with black powder and putting them in their little ball pistols and things like that. Stuff can explode.
I think there's a difference between a little amount that you're putting in a replica pistol and then making a, quote, cannon-like device out of it. It does make you wonder what they were trying to shoot out of the cannon. And if it was, they just went and got, like, like the block from a Camaro or a wife's place setting or just dumped it all in.
There is a photograph on OregonLive.com. The remains of the cannon says that it appeared to be 6 to 8 inches in diameter. A metal bar in the photo appeared to be the handle used to push the cannon. The barrel itself estimated to be about 2 inches in diameter and a couple of feet long, scattered in the area after the explosion. So, yes, it was not a cannon per se. It was a pipe with powder in it.
It's like playing a game of human perfection. You know what I mean? Just, all right. Well, in any event. All right. Are we done there?
We are done there.
All right. Fantastic. Word of the wise, kids. There's your Darwin Watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Don't. Another one bites the dust. Don't. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey.
Yeah, it's like one big self-regulating Jenga game, the human race. You know what I mean? You just take out one block too many, yeah, you don't get to play the next round. All right, let's do one more watch here, and then we will roll today's top five.
Right. Well, let's do the Cheney watch.
I can see you're just torn there.
I'm torn. They're both
tyranny of choice.
Delightful. Let's do the Cheney watch.
Here's your Cheney watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Every time see you looking my way, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby.
Here is Don Taylor with your Cheney Watch.
A heart pump has been implanted in the chest of former Vice President Dick Cheney as his heart disease has become end-stage congestive heart failure. In such kinds of heart failure, the prognosis is poor. Only 8% of patients may survive for 2 years. With this left ventricle assist device, there's now a 58% chance for Cheney to survive for 2 more years. He got the implant done at Inova Fairfax Heart Vascular Institute last week. He has suffered from 5 heart attacks so far. The device is implanted next to the heart and has been connected to a wire that runs through the abdomen to an external battery pack in the exterior of the body.
I wonder how many babies he's gone through by now. I mean, we've got to be into the double digits already. And there's this Star Wars Extended Universe novel, and I forget which one it is, but the... I at one point had asked the question, it was something about how Darth Vader, it was like, how does he eat? You know, it was like, well, where does, I mean, which is a fair question, right? Because there's the, you know, the whole thing in Empire where there's the, you know, and the thing. Mm-hmm. But I was like, well, is that how he eats? Or is that, you know, and like, how does he toilet, as they say at the hospital? And this guy had like transcribed this whole thing from one of the Extended Universe books, which described it was actually kind of great because I'm a guy who I always want to know how the trick was done. I always want to know about the man behind the curtain. I don't ever like to. To me, there's no glory in mystery. I always like to know this, you know, how everything works. I know D.B. Cooper is romantic to some people because he was never found. Me, I want to know. I want to see the spot where he landed. So I like to know how Darth Vader eats. And there's this like massive system of like tubes, and I swear to God, it says this in one of the Lucas sanctioned Star Wars books: tubes and colostomy bags, which is like a thing you don't really think of, you know, when you're like an all powerful Sith Lord. But you know,
that
whatever.
Explains the cape
and the grumpiness. I would think too. You know, it's sort of a, I am in my own feces. You know,
yeah.
But
it would be hard on the self esteem.
Seriously, I mean, he's just you know. You know, he's having to wear rubberized clothing all the time. And anyway.
And that explains why he's always dressed in black. Because the stain, you know, accidental staining would not show up as easily.
It's always a heavy day when you're Darth Vader. But he was like this whole series of tubes and whatever. But that's what Chaney is, right? I mean, they're basically just implanting more and more machinery into him. And the ratio of machine to man with that guy is now beginning to shift. And the fact that he's got, I mean, I'm not trying to be uncaring. I wish him a long life and the best of health, as I do to all federal officials. It seems to me that he is not only at a stage in his whole heart problem, which is not like a recent development that would kill anybody else like now, but it seems like, medically speaking, the odds are that he should have died a long time ago. You know? I understand. I'm glad that he's alive. Again, I'm glad that all federal officials are alive and in good health, and I hope that they remain in that condition. I'm just saying, logistically speaking, it seems improbable that he's still here. So I believe this is because he is now becoming impervious, is my point.
Apparently he has two more years of evil to do and just refuses to leave.
That's the thing, is like he's just too mean to die. You know, he just can't be, you know, he's just
honestly,
like,
how much more evil can he have in him? Why doesn't he just give up now?
There's things to be done. Dreams to be crushed, hopes to be broken, people to be put on a wheel.
One last kitten.
I mean, that's really it. I mean, he's like Creedy, you know, there's like a black bag still to be filled. So, did you ever hear that time that I guess maybe not. I think we might have bleeped it successfully. That time that we very nearly played the F word on the air, The Onion used to do this great bit called The Onion Presidential Address. And it was, they started it when Bush went into office, when W went in. And it was, they would do this weekly address. It was now a, you know, a message for the President of the United States. And it was a parody of the President's weekly radio address. And W would come on and say something stupid and wah, wah. But occasionally they would throw you a curveball where it would be like Cheney or it would be Rumsfeld or somebody. And the one that was Cheney, it was just him talking in that low sort of like, my fellow Americans, I'm here to. And it was just, he went on and on about something, and there was really no joke. There was really no setup. And then it just ended with, and go F yourself. And that was it. And like out of the blue, except he didn't say F. And it was out of the blue for no reason. And it was like live on the air. And that's every time now that there's any soundbite or any story about him, I just hear him saying, so I'm going to be alive for two more years to continue my reign of evil. And go F yourself. All right. So there you go. So Dick Cheney still strides the land like a great striding thing. Beware! There's your Cheney watch for Monday, the Rick Emerson radio program.
Every time I see you looking my way, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby.
All right. Hey, by the way, somebody asked here in the Skyping box what blog it is. In other words, where the Oregonian bloggers, the Oregon blog that you were talking about with your review, Ryan White.
Just go to OregonLive.com/music, right, which is the homepage for all of our music coverage. And it's the easiest portal in.
Excellent. All right. Let's see. Anything else we need to? We didn't get our True Blood thing. But really, what is there to? I got like four thoughts on True Blood, and then I'm pretty much done.
We had a penis watch, but we could wait on that, I suppose.
Well, I probably have to bump that. Do you have actual thoughts about True Blood last night?
Other than, and of course, warning people ahead of time, there will be spoilers here, so don't stop whining. One thing is that apparently they are threatening now that skanky vampire guy wants to turn Tara into his eternal immortal love.
Will you be my vampire bride?
And it's like, and that's all we need is Tara not being killable. I mean, come on.
No, she's just a cancer. She's just the worst.
I am happy to see Lafayette finding love, although I'm waiting to find how is that going to go awry.
Well, Lafayette's boyfriend is still like being, it's like being Harry Callahan's partner, you know? It's just going to end poorly for you.
Yeah, he's going to get snatched by Nazi werewolves or something. You know that. And then, of course, there's a new chick, a new blonde chick. Jason is interested in the new blonde chick who couldn't go into the bar, but she wanted to fool around with him out in the woods in the swamp by the thing. So she's going to turn out to be some kind of crazy water nymph or succubus or something. Because there, apparently this one particular place in Louisiana is like a nexus for every kind of supernatural being that has ever been invented.
It's like some Richard Scarry in Hell sort of a thing where everyone, you know, and you are right that it'll be like, she'll be a mermaid or some crap or a seahorse. You know, I mean, it's just like, I mean, like, what would anything surprise you at this point?
No.
I mean, like, if she just turned into like a platypus, I mean, No. Here are my notes last night, and I've stopped actually even writing down thoughts. I just make, you know, in other words, I no longer look back and assess and go, how did I feel about tonight?
Just make random horrified noises and then just transcribe them like, rah!
I grunt and scrawl. I just noted here. Here are a couple of my thoughts last night on my thoughts of True Blood. And we've got this. It says I was rooting. This text says I was rooting for the dog to catch and eat Tara. Then I changed the channel.
No such luck.
I just wrote. I keep expecting this to flat out turn into a porn film, and a big gay porn film at that, which is fine. It's just one of those things that like the setup becomes. I think the moment that I realized I was just watching a sexless porn film was when Jason Stackhouse pulled that chick over and he's pretending to be a cop and he just strides up to her with no shirt, hairless, greased up, and his pants shoved down like he's in a Cisco video. And then just saying like, or no, what was it? D'Angelo? Was that the guy? Who was the video where he was just gyrating in a circle nude?
Look at my You're going to have to narrow it down.
Saying, look at my pubic bone. Well, in any event. And I remember, and he's saying, I'm going to need you to get out of the car and give me your phone number. And I was like, this is it. Here comes the hump fest.
Now, did you go back and catch up on the first episode? Because that was the one with the Sam Merlot vampire guy, Bill Compton, homoerotic dream.
Oh, yeah, sequence, yeah, yeah.
Which was like where you're just watching going, what the hell?
I'm all out of hot water in my house. I'm going to have to shower here. Let's see. The werewolf guy talking to Sookie and saying, I can't tell you. This is were business.
Couldn't that be the beginning of an Abbott and Costello skit?
Yeah. Or just
were business. What do you mean where? Over there? No.
No
were
business.
Where?
Let's see. I note this to myself at about 9:20. Jason Stackhouse has become the Shemp of True Blood. I feel so bad for that actor because now they figured out that the whole thing is him just being a stooge, you know?
Yeah.
It's like he at least last season was kind of interesting. Now he's just a tool.
Yeah.
You know, and he was always kind of a goof, but now he's strictly like a Gilligan on that show.
I want you to make me a cop. I'm kind of half-assedly blackmailing you to make me a cop.
So hijinks can ensue. He is the hijinks creator. That's what it is. And then, you know, and then what's his name? Goddamn, that guy that plays Andy Belfleur. And I just keep thinking, you were on The Wire.
Yeah.
Et tu? I mean, is this how much your rent costs that you have to be on this? Let's see. And then I noted the other thing earlier about how it is now, I think, officially the gayest show in the history of Gayonia. And finally, that thing where what's his guts? The guy who, you know, who's going to be Terror's vampire beau.
Yeah.
That gag where he's showing how fast he can text on his phone, which was so funny they had to do it twice in a row. Which is just them, but hello, speeding the film up.
Yeah.
I think D.W. Griffith pioneered that technique. You know, like 109 years ago. You film somebody doing something, then you play it back faster. And then they do it twice. And it wasn't impressive when they did it last year when they had, what's her name, Michelle Forbes, like jiggling back in place really fast, like in lieu of a better special effect.
And at the end of the episode, we have Sookie fighting off the vampire by suddenly turning into one of the X-Men.
Seriously, she becomes Storm or something, and she's bolting him, you know, doing the unlimited power thing, which comes up from nowhere.
Yeah, she did something like that with weird, what's her name, shaky lady. Previously, she had done that like last season in one situation. She was like, "What are you?" But now,
it's just the worst show. It's the worst show that's ever existed. All right,
and we watch it every week.
Yes, yes, we do. All right, let's do something different. Here's your top five for Monday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness. Counting is ecstasy. I love to count.
You're sneering.
Don't you?
I can see you passing judgment on my top five right now.
Just one of them.
Whatever. So these are the top five soundtracks. So you did your own take on this list on Friday. Top five soundtracks better than the film from which they came.
And I will admit, three of these were on my consideration
list. Almost list?
They were on my list.
So this is my take on the same list. I'm not saying it's better. Just saying it's like when you and your brother do something, you know, you take a painting home for your mom from school and she goes, I like them both equally in different ways. Our top fives are equal, just in different ways. That's all I'm saying. These are the top five songs, soundtracks rather, that are better than the movie from which they came. Don Taylor.
Honorable mention, Purple Rain.
Now here's my thing about this is that it's honorable mention because it's hard to see Purple Rain sort of objectively at this point. It is pretty damn cheesy.
Oh, it's awful.
I mean, it's... And the thing is also, I don't want it to be bad. You know, like, I want Purple Rain to be a great film. And, you know...
I think we've actually talked about this before, but you ever read Chuck Klosterman talking about Roadhouse and how it's the perfect movie because in every single scene there's something that happens that could not possibly happen in real life?
Yes.
Purple Rain's like that. And the moment that seals it for me is the very end in this song where they just walk up on stage... And they nail it as a band, having never rehearsed it and not even knowing that there are lyrics. And then he gets that. Then they go into that last song, and he gets the squirt gun out.
You cut him a certain amount of slack because it's I was going to say a vanity project, which I guess would be an unintended pun, this sort of weird fictional autobiographical thing, and it was meant to be sort of absurdist and flamboyant, but even cutting it those amounts of slack, it's just dreadful in many, many, many ways.
We have to cut him more and more slack all the time, it seems. I got an email the other day from a friend who's from Minneapolis, huge Prince fan, and, you know, got her hands on the leak of this new record that came out last weekend, distributed in the Daily Mirror in London, right, and every copy or whatever. And there's a lyric in one of the songs along the lines of, from central Minnesota comes the purple Yoda.
That hurts. It causes me almost physical pain. Did you see that interview he gave a couple weeks ago where he was saying the internet is over?
Which I actually thought he got a little too much crap for, because I didn't know he had a record coming out until he said that. So it rather alerted me to the fact that he was doing anything since that god-awful Minnesota Vikings fight song that he wrote last year that seemed more like a dirge.
So therefore it worked.
So you were thinking that was an attention-grabbing story? That was the whole goal there?
I don't know if he thought it that far through, but it sure as hell worked.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it's a great album, really. And I know he doesn't like being defined by this album, but it really is. Not only is it a definitive album for him, certainly, but this song specifically, in many ways, sums up all that is great and excessive about the '80s, and about his career certainly, but also about the '80s. I mean, because it's sort of a masterfully wrought power ballad that comes intact with cliches, but does them better than almost anyone else.
And he also does the one thing that I've always wished he'd do more of in this song, which is just play the hell out of the guitar.
Yeah, an amazing guitar player, and a really, not even underrated, just people sometimes forget.
Yeah.
You know? All right, these are the top five soundtracks better than the film from which they came. Don Taylor?
Number five, Hackers.
Hackers. What a terrible film. What a terrible, awful, no good, very bad film.
Yes, this was on my consideration list for my list. Because, good soundtrack, not a good movie.
The thing about this soundtrack is that, I mean, you know, I use a lot of electronic music on this show just because because it's perfect for stuff like talk radio, because it's energetic without putting anybody in any specific kind of mood. It's like a neutral sort of energy. But there was that whole misguided, which I think we all knew at the time was misguided, that whole misguided push in the mid-90s that, like, electronica is the new rock. You know, and they were, like, trying to, they're trying to get us all to think that, like, the Chemical Brothers were going to be, like, you know, they're the new Rolling Stones, and everybody's going to go stand in a room, and again, with the glow sticks and the candy necklace and the staring and the, no.
Pacifiers.
Yeah, and we all knew that that was crap, and this movie was sort of the apotheosis of that whole thing. It was, like, the apex of this corporate America telling us, and now everyone will like this. And as a and sometimes Americans buy into that, and sometimes we just go, we're not gonna. And this was one of those times. Great soundtrack, though. I mean, if you wanted a representative soundtrack of that time and this kind of music in the 90s, this soundtrack, you don't get much better than the Hacker soundtrack. It's really good. The movie is dreadful. It's so bad. It's so bad. It's so unbelievably badly bad. I can't even... I mean, and then there's a Hackers 2. I mean, I don't even know what that... I've never even... I've never even seen it playing it. Not on Stars, not on Encore. I mean, not even on channels no one cares about. It must play somewhere. You must be able to rent it someplace. I just don't know where. Ugh. Isn't Matthew Lillard in this, too? Because Angelina Jolie's in this.
I've managed to burn almost everything about this movie out of my brain.
Oh, I don't think I ever saw it.
Oh, it's awful.
I do remember it being awful. I remember Angelina Jolie was in it. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Well, this is during that whole period, too, of like Johnny Mnemonic and The Net with Sandra Bullock and Dennis Miller.
Sneakers.
And, but no, see, you don't love Sneakers into this, though. That was Sneakers is a fine film. Sneakers is a fantastic film. This, however, is Dreck. Top five soundtracks that are better than the movies from which they came. Dawn Taylor?
Number 4, Easy Rider.
I almost feel like it's wrong to put this on the list, kind of, because, again, like Purple Rain, it's a capsule of a time and a specific period, which by definition dates it. But
a worse movie than Purple Rain.
God damn, I hate this movie. I tried.
Like soccer, I tried.
I got this whole thing where I like stuff to happen, and you know, and for things to take place. And this movie, I think Easy Rider, and Dawn, you know more about movies than I do, but maybe this is just one of those, like, you had to be there, or you had to see it at the right time in your own life.
I think so. Easy Rider was an important movie as far as the development, the direction the films took in the 70s. It's one of those seminal 70s movies that helped push filmmaking in a different direction. And it's not... In my opinion, it's not a terrible movie, but again, though, I am not of that time, and I don't find it particularly watchable. I don't enjoy watching it, but I will say that, I mean, it is incredibly self-indulgent. The whole thing is really, but again, though, that's what it is. I think if you take it in context, it is what we now call, like with Purple Rain, a vanity project.
I feel like maybe I just, it was a thing where you had to be at the right person at the right time in your own life and in that moment in society, because you can't recreate those even theoretically in your own head when you watch this. I feel like the thing about Easy Rider, though, is that at some point, like 15 years from now, there's going to be some dick writing for Spin Magazine, which will still be smug and pretentious in the future, and they will seize on Richard Linklater's Slacker and try to say that it's the definitive film of my generation, and then I will be horrified. And I feel like that's what Easy Rider is. It's like Slacker in that it doesn't really go anywhere or do anything, but it gets, you know.
Yeah, Easy Rider is more important as a film because it was part of... it was a very important film in changing the way ratings were done at the time that it came out. It's more important in that aspect than it is actual filmmaking. It's not particularly influential or even memorable as far as a movie.
We should say, though, in terms of soundtrack, though, it's fantastic. It's got a lot, you know, Roger McGuinn and it's got the band and Hendrix and a couple songs by Steppenwolf. Born to be Wild is the one that, you know, obviously gets associated with this, but, you know. All right. Top five soundtracks better than the film from which they came. Dawn Taylor?
Number 3, Watchmen.
I did not go the obvious. I didn't pull the Leonard Cohen for this because he's been raped enough. Thank you very much.
It was actually a hard decision for me to decide whether to put this on my list or not, and ultimately I ended up leaving it off, but that was a tough one to decide, because, yeah, this is a bad, bad movie, and with some really, really terrific music in it.
Such a great collection of music. Such an unpleasant watching experience I had. I who's watching The Watchmen? Me, once. That's it. I think you nailed it when you said that there's these two moments in Watchmen that sum up why the soundtrack is so good and why the movie's so bad. One is when they're burying the comedian or something, and it's they're using Sounds of Silence.
Yeah.
And that's because, like, some guy wanted to use it, and some other guy had a big enough checkbook. And the second one is when, at the end, when they're playing All Along the Watchtower, you know, as they're drawing near to the snow-covered lair, and it's solely and simply because there's that line, two riders were approaching and the wind began to howl. It's because that scene takes place in the movie, and somebody went, I don't know, is there some song about riders and wind howling? Anyone? I don't know, some Dylan Hendricks out of something or other. Well, can we buy it?
Watchtower, Watchmen?
I mean,
I smell a perfect synergy.
It's just lazy. And, you know, and you have to work really hard to make me dislike the use of All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, which is a song that, in my opinion, goes with almost any scene in any movie ever. You could put that underneath a Rachel Ray program, and it would work for me most of the time. You have to work really hard to make that clash with a movie, but by God, they did it. And I'm not even going to mention the sullying of Leonard Cohen, except to say that there will be a reckoning someday, and those involved will pay dearly. So let's have no illusions about that. All right. This is My Chemical Romance. I actually don't hate this cover of this Dylan song. All right. These are the top five soundtracks better than the films that created them, Dawn Taylor.
Number two, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Go ahead.
You're wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong.
I know you dislike this movie. I know you personally dislike this movie. But to say that it's a bad movie and to put it this high on your list.
I didn't say it was a bad movie. No. I didn't say it was a bad movie. No, the key to why this is number two is in the phrasing of the...
Is this in the strength of the soundtrack?
It is. That's the thing. It is the ratio. It's the proportion. In other words, like, who expects anything from the movie Hackers? You know, either the soundtrack or the movie. You know, they both deliver exactly what you thought. The ratios are more or less the same there. You know, in other words, the soundtrack is good. It's a good soundtrack. It's representative. The movie is bad. You know, but you're kind of getting, you know, nothing is really skewed there in terms of proportion. Here, I'm just getting all these texts that just say you're wrong. Here, the movie is, I think, what it is. In other words, you're either gonna like what the Coen brothers do, because they got, you know, they kind of got the one mode, which is Hicks using big words, in my opinion, or they don't. And that's, you know, and if you're into that, and I don't mean to be snarky about it, I'm just saying they do what they do and they do it really well, and a lot of folks like it. I am not typically one of those folks, but the soundtrack so massively outstripped the achievements of that film. I mean, they were really, the Coens themselves were, you know, overshadowed by two things. They were overshadowed by the soundtrack, and they were overshadowed by, and I forget his name, but the guy who did the cinematography for it. And his name eludes me at the moment. But if you ask anybody what they remember about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, zero out of 100 people will mention anything that does not have to do with the cinematography or the music.
There aren't a lot of soundtracks that spawn entire national tours.
Yeah.
Like this did, the Down on the Mountain.
Which...
Down from the Mountain tour.
Yeah. I mean, my mother, who was at the time 72 or something, and who doesn't really get out of her bustling hometown of Kennewick all that often, actually drove all the way up here to go to the Down to the Mountain concert, which she would not have known about had it not been for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. And she's not a big movie watcher. Nope. So fine movie. The soundtrack just unbelievably outstrips everything.
See, I love this movie. I know that you do not, but I love this movie, and I do think that the soundtrack, the art direction, all of it, for me, is of a piece. And it all works for me. I really wouldn't say that I think that the soundtrack is that far better than the film itself.
So just so you know, from my perspective, where I'm coming from, is that it's not intended to be that much of a knock on the film. Like, I don't really care for the movie, but it's not a knock on the movie so much as it is the wholly disproportionate success and influence of the soundtrack.
One of my favorite Bluesfest moments, Chris Thomas King was here this year, who plays Tommy Johnson in the movie. Mm-hmm. And he was, before he did his workshop set one of the days, he was overleaning, looking over all the boats and stuff. And he had on a black suit with red pinstripes, ascot, pocket square,
Stetson, and he reaches into his jacket and pulls out a flask and takes a pull off it. And I was like, now that's a blues
that's
man.
That's awesome.
That's a blues man.
That's fantastic.
That's the real blues.
So yeah, you know, great looking film, and I know a lot of people, you know, love the Coen brothers. The performances are fine. The lasting legacy of that film, I think, in the broader popular culture, is the soundtrack. So that's why that's there. Don't go thinking I'm hating just for the sake of. It's not like I'm just looking for shots at the Coen brothers to take. I mean, that ship has sailed. These are the top five soundtracks better than the films that produced them. Don Taylor.
Number one, Less Than Zero.
Now, this is a terrible film.
Yeah, and this is another one that I thought really long and hard about putting on my list as well. Because, yeah.
See, now,
the only two good things about this movie are the soundtrack and Robert Downey Jr.'s performance.
I would also say James Spader's performance. I think James Spader is actually better than Robert Downey Jr. in some ways, but Downey Jr. is right. He's really good. Spader is just so unbelievably creepy in a role where he basically does nothing but just stand and glower and say, hello, Julian, you know. But, you know, here's the reason why this is number one. Because you have a groundbreaking revolutionary novel, whether anybody likes it or not. You know, it's not everybody's taste. By an astonishingly, at the time, young and gifted writer. A novel that was allegedly written in like 9 days on a meth jag. You know, you have a talented cast. You know, not like Jamie Lee Gertz is going to make anybody, she's not going to be a big Oscar winner probably, but she can certainly act. And then you got Andrew McCarthy, Robert Downey Jr., James Spader. The supporting cast is all really good. You have Rick Rubin, providing the soundtrack. And that, of course, is the only part that works, even though all of this other talent being brought to bear just manages to fail miserably. But the soundtrack, the first appearance of Public Enemy's Bring the Noise, gave us Going Back to Cali by LL Cool J. I think it made its first appearance on Less Than Zero before it was on Bigger and Deafer or whatever record it showed up on. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And again, it's also a very representative sample of the music of the time, especially, I think, in that sort of world, at least as it was depicted by Less Than Zero, because it's got a lot of your West Coast hip-hop and a lot of glam and Poison and whatever. And, you know, and again, the movie is just such dreck. I mean, it's just such irredeemable garbage. You know, that if you put next to that a soundtrack featuring not only Glenn Danzig, but Roy Orbison singing a Glenn Danzig song, I mean, you can't skew your proportions more than that. Oh, by the way, Bret Easton Ellis has written a sequel to Less Than Zero, and it's awful. So save yourself that $29. All right. Ryan White, read him in print in the Oregonian at oregonlive.com/music.
Correct.
Excellent. Or in print the Oregonian at some point that's not this week
comes
when
out,
you're on vacation.
It comes out of newsstands. Stores have it.
Excellent.
You can still get it home delivered. I do.
Well, I was just saying...
Mine ended up on the roof the other day.
They could read it this week if they wanted to, the print edition. Will you be in the print edition this week?
No.
See, that's what I'm saying. Or they could just wait until you're in it. I mean, really, what is the point otherwise?
Thank you.
Without you, it's just fish wrapping. So. All right. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, and our chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Monday, July 19th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.